Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we program weird and wonderful science directly into your mind. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, Marilena De Meo talks about autism and oxytocin. But first up, here's news of vasopressin and disaster. Vasopressin for autism? People living with autism spectrum disorder suffer from social deficits that can range from being unable to speak to having trouble understanding social signals and how to respond to social situations. Researchers at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, tested whether vasopressin, a brain chemical associated with forming social bonds, could be a treatment to help the symptoms. Roche Pharmaceuticals in Switzerland tested the opposite hypothesis. Previous studies have found that problems with the regulation of the vasopressin signaling pathway in the brain produces social deficits in rodents. Monkeys that were markedly less social were found to have lower levels of vasopressin in their cerebrospinal fluid. Vasopressin is the difference between a species of prairie voles that mate for life and a species of prairie voles that are polygamous. In humans who don't have autism, studies have shown that treatment with one dose of a nasal spray of vasopressin enhances a variety of social abilities, including memory for emotional faces, identification of social words, and cooperative behaviour. In people with post-stroke aphasia, a language disorder, a single dose of vasopressin nasal spray has been shown to enhance speech and word formation. In people with central diabetes insipidus, a single dose of vasopressin nasal spray has been shown to improve short and long-term memory. The team at Stanford University previously published findings that children with autism spectrum disorder have lower levels of vasopressin in their cerebrospinal fluid compared to children without autism. Further, they found that patients with autism spectrum disorder with the lowest amount of vasopressin in their cerebrospinal fluid have the most severe symptoms. The Stanford team gave a nasal spray containing vasopressin to 17 children with autism, aged 6 to 12 years. Another 13 children with autism served as a control group and got a placebo spray. Before and after the 4-week treatment, the research team asked parents to rate the children on a questionnaire called the Social Responsiveness Scale, SRS2, which asks how often the children would rather be alone with others, for example, and how often they avoid eye contact. This 65-question scale results in gender-adjusted scores of 37 to 90 in girls and 38 to 90 for boys. Children treated with vasopressin showed significantly more improvement than those in the placebo group. Weirdly, the children that started with a higher vasopressin level responded more strongly than the rest, the opposite of what you'd expect. A problem with the study is the small sample size, so the Stanford team is recruiting for a new trial with 100 children. Meanwhile, at Roche Pharmaceuticals in Basel, Switzerland, they had the opposite hypothesis, that vasopressin was responsible for overreactive emotional responses from people with autism. In an experiment with rats, blocking a vasopressin receptor appeared to reduce the animal's abnormally heightened brain response to the presence of a juvenile rat. The Roche team recruited 223 adult men with autism to test a compound called balovaptan that blocks a vasopressin receptor in the brain. The 148 men who took the drug improved according to a social responsiveness scale assessment, but those who got a placebo improved just as much. Most researchers would have concluded that their treatment worked no better than a placebo. But the Roche researchers have concluded that the social responsiveness scale questionnaire is the problem. A different measurement of autistic spectrum disorder, called the Vineland 2 test, showed the vasopressin-blocking drug worked better than a placebo. The authors of both studies admit that perhaps autism spectrum disorder involves vasopressin problems that mean that some people's symptoms could be helped by extra vasopressin, and some people's symptoms could be helped by blocking vasopressin. Perhaps the fact that one study looked at children and the other study only looked at adult men could also be a factor. More research is needed. Disaster! The United Nations have released a report warning the world that human civilization and ultimately our species may end if we don't transform the way we grow our food and manufacture our goods, because of changes wrought by decades of pillaging and poisoning forests, oceans, soil and air threaten society at least as much as climate change. 132 nations met to validate the Summary for Policymakers, which was researched and written by 450 experts from around the world. The report says 1 million animal and plant species face extinction, many within decades. Around 10% of insects face extinction, and more than 30% of reef-forming corals and marine mammals, and more than 40% of amphibians. Of the world's estimated 5.9 million land-based species, more than 500,000 have insufficient habitat for long-term survival. The biggest drivers of environmental destruction are changes in the land and sea use, exploitation of organisms, climate change, pollution, and invasive species. Plastic pollution has increased tenfold since 1980, and up to 400 million tons of industrial waste are dumped in the world's waters every year. 60 billion tons of resources are extracted every year, nearly double the amount in 1980. All but 7% of major marine fish stocks are in decline or exploited to the limit of sustainability, despite efforts by regional management organisations to fish sustainably. Drawing from 15,000 sources and an underlying 1,800-page report, the executive summary details how our species' growing footprint and appetites have compromised the natural renewal of resources that sustain civilization, starting with fresh water, breathable air, and productive soil. We're eroding the very foundations of our economies, livelihoods, food security, health, and quality of life worldwide. We need transformative change in our means of production, which means a fundamental system-wide reorganisation. The report doesn't make policy recommendations, but does suggest we reduce meat consumption, halt deforestation in tropical countries, discourage luxury consumption, slash perverse subsidies, the ones that encourage bad behaviour, and embrace the concept of a low-growth economy. In this week before the election, the Australian Environment Minister, Melissa Price, has committed to continue focusing on the economy as the solution to all problems. Funding for the environment has dropped by 40% since the Liberal National Party took power in 2013. So what are the environment policies of the major parties? The Liberal National Party coalition promise $100 million for an environment restoration fund to clean up coasts and waterways, protect threatened species and reduce waste, and $189 million over 4 years for the Direct Action Climate Solutions Fund to be paid to the big polluters, in part for revegetation of degraded land. The Labor Party have announced a new Federal Environment Act, a science-based National Environment Protection Authority, reversing the Coalition's reduction of marine protected areas, a $100 million Native Species Protection Fund, $200 million over 5 years to double Indigenous ranges, $200 million for urban rivers and corridors. the Green Party have announced new environmental laws, a federal environment protection authority, independent of politicians, a $2 billion nature fund, expanded science-based network of marine parks, and ending native forest logging. The Science Party supports a carbon emissions trading scheme, an end to the logging of native forests, an 800% renewable energy target, and to double research funding to $18.4 billion. The election is this week. It's time to save ourselves by reversing our trashing of the planet. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Can oxytocin help people with autism? Marilena De Mayo is a PhD candidate at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre. She was also a participant in FameLab. I began by asking her, what is autism?
Autism diagnosis is based on two key symptom domains. So one is social communication difficulties. So this can be things like struggling to read others' emotions, responding appropriately when you can read the emotion, not necessarily being able to express the emotions super well, and restricted and repetitive behaviours and interests. There's a line that if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, but the restricted and repetitive behaviours and interests can be anything from a really obsessive interest in a specific area and or really enjoying a certain movement or a certain way of having, or even having a set way that you have to do things each day. So Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory is Penny would arguably be kind of a restricted behaviour.
Except he's a bit of a cartoon, isn't he? He's way more functional than you would expect a real person on the spectrum to be.
It's a tricky one, and the whole spectrum can be a very broad spectrum, and it's much more about kind of the onset when it starts, these behaviours start. So these autism is generally diagnosed in childhood, or at least has the behaviours, these experiences begin in childhood, even if it's not diagnosed until later. So you'd need to do a much more thorough investigation of Sheldon before you could diagnose him.
And so is it normally diagnosed through taking that sort of a history and going through these criteria?
So the main way autism is diagnosed is so through a history, often with parents. It depends a little on the age of the person seeking diagnosis. There is interview schedule called the Autism Diagnostic Interview Schedule. And there's also the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. And so that has different adaptations based on someone's verbal ability, how well they speak and how well they can communicate, and their age. So how you assess a young child is very different to how you assess a 25-year-old.
So people on the autistic spectrum, you were talking about sometimes very narrow and specialised interests, so they can have a deep knowledge of a subject and sometimes they can be hyper-focused?
Yes, that's true, but that's not as common as the media would have you believe. So there is common themes of often people with autism do have specialised interests, but the Rain Man level of savantness is not as common as it seems in the media.
It's more good for a story.
More good for a story.
And so with the challenges for people living with autism, what are the things that can be done to help them?
So at the moment, there is actually no medical treatment for these core symptoms of autism. The only approved medication are actually antipsychotics for kind of associated distress, so irritability or, you know, extreme temper tantrums. So behavioural interventions are currently our best practice intervention. And so that is teaching people with autism, generally children, it's been shown to be most effective the younger it's begun, how to interact with the social world. So that person is smiling. What does a smile mean? Oh, they feel happy. What does happiness feel like? And so this is quite time intensive. It's very consuming for parents if it's being implemented for young children, with some studies recommending up to 40 hours a week of intervention for children with autism. So that's a really big problem. That's a really big demand on both the child and the parents, both by way of time and expense. It's very expensive.
And so your work is looking at another type of intervention.
Yes, so our work is looking at oxytocin, which has been kind of nicknamed the social hormone. So it's released in large amounts when women give birth. That surge of love for their baby, that's based on oxytocin. So it's used to augment breastfeeding and induce labour. But we're looking at it as a nasal spray. So previous research has shown that when you give someone a single dose of oxytocin, they actually get better at reading emotions and they pay more attention to the eye region, which is a very expressive, interesting part of the face. And so that early interest in showing that oxytocin maybe improves social skills has suggested that maybe it would help for disorders such as autism, where social skills and social challenges are really a key problem. And so that's what our work is looking at.
So the previous research has shown that people feel more social when they're given a nasal dose of oxytocin. How does that translate into social behaviour?
So it seems to improve accuracy at reading emotions, and it seems to increase feelings of trust. And so when you are playing, there's different games that they use to assess trust, and you're more likely to trust an unknown partner following oxytocin intervention. So this has been translated into early work looking at as a treatment, and the results have been very mixed. So there's been some findings that suggest improved social responsiveness, so that children and adults with autism have more social engagement and are more willing to engage in that back and forth, while others have not found anything. So our study is new and a bit different in that it is looking at a really broad range of children. So our sample is aged between 3 and 12, which is a really broad range to begin to look at the different effects at different ages and whether there's an early age effect compared to a later age effect. And the other thing that's really interesting about our study is we're beginning to try and look at not just parent or clinician, so researcher response ratings. So we've seen previously very big placebo effects in autism research generally, and we've also seen very strong placebo effects in oxytocin research. So in a previous trial done by our team, we found that there was a significant impact, meaning that people who thought they were receiving oxytocin rated their improvement much more highly than the people who thought they were getting placebo, and parents evidenced this response bias. So we're beginning to try and look and see if we can identify things that are more objective and less likely to be influenced by participant or parent expectations. One of the things that we do know about the development of autism is that children with autism's brains develop more rapidly than children who don't develop autism. By the brain developing sooner, it's not getting this refining, this shaping experience. So we can see that the brain is enlarged in children with autism, and this begins at about 6 months of age and seems to continue up until about 4 or 5 years of age. And so this is a really important enlargement because it suggests that the brain isn't developing in response to experience. So if you think about the experience that a four-year-old has, that's quite complex. There's this saying that neurons that fire together wire together. So as you engage in social experiences, you get better at them and you begin to build almost highways between the relevant parts of the brain. And so if these highways are being built or these brain structures are being built without the refining experiences, you can think of this as being developing inefficient highways throughout the brain. So that's what we think might be happening in the brains of children with autism, that they're developing a bit too early without the social experience that maybe refines the brain and refines that development. And so later in life, they're working against some system that's not optimized for the processing, if you can think about it.
And my understanding is that one of the many ways the brain uses to optimize at various ages is a pruning of some of these connections. Does that mean that they're not doing as much pruning at these very young ages, maybe?
I think it's that they're pruning too early is is what I believe the evidence currently suggests is that there's this developmental exuberance, which I think is a great word, that happens a little bit too early, and then the pruning starts before those refining social experiences and those more complex experiences. But this is still in early stages, so a lot of the neural research is looking back and looking at correlations and associations, and we don't know exactly what's happening. We can just observe these trends.
And there's been some stories of potential connections between things like gut bacteria and autism. Is there any evidence behind that?
I can't really speak to that in depth. So there is some evidence that gut problems are more common in children with autism, but the causal link is still not there. It's very observational. It just seems that there is a higher incidence of gastrointestinal issues in children with autism compared to those that don't.
So what are some of the key challenges that people with autism may encounter?
So this can be very individual. So as I said previously, you've met one individual with autism, you've met one individual. And so this is very variable, but it can really range from people who are nonverbal or limited verbal, which means they struggle to speak and sometimes struggle to understand the words that are spoken to them, to people who are quite high functioning. The label Asperger's was removed in the most recent version of the diagnostic criteria, but often that is a very useful label for some that really identify with it. And so someone who maybe is on the more high end of the spectrum might just struggle to read social cues and struggle a little bit more with the social areas, and that's where those kind of Sheldon types might come in. Not that I am diagnosing Sheldon. So the estimates of intellectual disability, so an IQ below 70, ranges between 30 to 70% of people with autism, and that partly depends on how you define autism and which version the diagnostic criteria is used.
So you mentioned earlier that there was a very large placebo response in some of the work. Does that indicate that some people would do a lot better with a lot more attention paid to what they're doing?
Potentially, we really don't know. So there is some suggestions for effective oxytocin treatment that maybe we need to look more at the biological basis. So they recently did a study looking at children with autism and looked at plasma, so a certain level of oxytocin in the blood. And children with lower initial oxytocin plasma levels responded to the most to the oxytocin treatment. One of the new areas of oxytocin research is looking at if there are particular individuals with autism for whom oxytocin might be the best treatment. So one recent study found that children with autism that had lower initial oxytocin levels in their blood, looking at plasma levels, showed the most response in social behaviours following oxytocin treatment. So this is where the research is beginning to look as to whether or not we can predict how people will respond to oxytocin treatment. And so that's where those more objective markers become very useful, because if we can subdivide the population or create subtypes that this intervention helps, that would potentially improve and further the research and might explain why some of the promising findings haven't been replicated in other studies.
And how did you become interested in autism research?
That's a really good question. So I actually initially started volunteering at a sporting organisation for people with disabilities, and I was really intrigued by autism because I found the variation in the spectrum so vast, and I found the difference between someone who struggled to articulate and who was nonverbal versus someone who was really high functioning and could, very fascinating. And I thought understanding more about that and how to help particularly those who really are struggling was something that really brought me into research and brought me into my interest in autism.
If someone's interested in pursuing this line of work, what would they have to study at university?
Lots of different areas have filled into this. So my background is a psychology. I did a Bachelor of Psychology before working in an MRI research facility, which is where my interest in brain development came from. However, people in my team, we have medical doctors, we have people who have a Bachelor of Science, Bachelor of Neuroscience. It can be anything, really. So our trial is still recruiting and enrolling. So if you know a 3 to 6 year old in Sydney that would like to participate, let us know. So our trial is still ongoing and it will be really interesting to see where this work takes us. I'm very excited to see what happens with the different subtypes and the potential of creating predictors of response treatment. And that's one of the outcomes of this trial that we're hoping to be able to investigate later this year or early next year.
Well, Marilena, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Marilena De Meo, PhD candidate at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre, talking about autism spectrum disorder. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker, or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Do you have a science outreach grant you should tell me to apply for? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolfe. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2NVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XXFM in Canberra, and my local station 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Support the show by joining my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio or make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolfe. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolfe. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.